Chapter 30 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Lagimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 30. Directly I got back to London, I wrote to Olive and begged her to meet me. Immediately after my return, I had been flabbergasted by getting a letter from her in which she informed me that she was engaged to be married to George Montagu. George Montagu, now Earl of Sandwich, had been a small boy in my house at Winchester during my last 2 years there. He was consequently about 3 or 4 years younger than myself. He was, at Winchester, a fair-haired, blue-eyed, pretty boy with engaging manners, and I was very fond of him, though he later told me that I used to brock, Winchester for bully, him at school. I think my bullying only amounted to teasing, which at school is often a sign of affection. At any rate, I took a good deal of notice of him, and when he was a little older, I became a great friend of his. When I came down from Magdalen to Winchester for the day, as I did whenever I could get a chance or an excuse to do so, I always made a beeline for George, or Jidge, as I used to call him. My mother was a great friend of his mother, Lady Agneta Montagu, and I had stayed with his family at Werwell Priory, the beautiful old house on the River Test, where they lived at that time. After the Wilde affair I went abroad, and remained out of England for 2 or 3 years. When I came back, many of my friends cold-shouldered me, and others cut me outright. Knowing what I did about their own private lives, and also knowing that their attitude towards me was, in 99 cases out of 100, dictated not by moral considerations, but simply by snobbishness, hypocrisy, and cowardice, I mentally consigned them all to the devil, who, by the way, appears to have taken me at my word in a good many cases, and I cultivated a habit, which I have kept to this day, of never speaking to acquaintances who did not speak to me first, and of seeing people without appearing to look at them. All the same, there were still quite a lot of good fellows who were apparently just as pleased to see me and to frequent my society as they had been when I was in the heyday of my social prosperity. Curiously enough, or perhaps, when you come to think of it, not curiously at all, it was just those whose private lives were the least reputable who were most inclined to be nasty to me. Anyhow, George Montagu was one of those who was just as friendly and pleasant to me as he always had been, and just before I went to America, for a period of 2 or 3 months in London, we had been almost inseparable. George in those days was kept very short by his parents, and his uncle, old Lord Sandwich, Hinch, was by no means what might be described as a cheerful parter, at any rate as far as his nephew and heir was concerned. Although in reality I was already getting to the end of my financial tether, I was still in those days never without plenty of money in my pocket. This, no doubt, did nothing to lessen my attractions in the eyes of George and other gilded youths who still had no objection to being seen about at restaurants, clubs, music halls, and other places where they sing, in company with Lord Alfred Douglas. Just at the time when I was most friendly with George, and when he was in the habit of lunching and dining with me as my guest nearly every day, and using my rooms as if they were his own, his family arranged that he was to stand for Parliament. His father and mother, hearing that he was constantly in my company, told him that he must drop me as a preliminary to starting his election campaign. This he did, as Malvolio would say, without any mitigation or remorse. I was very much annoyed and very much hurt, and after a while, when I grasped what the situation was, I wrote and told him what I thought of him. I also later wrote a sonnet about him called The Traitor, which can be read in my collected poems. As always happens in such cases, the person who has done the injury poses as the injured, and ends by considering that he has been very badly treated. George had nothing to say for himself in reply to my letters, and instead of seeing me and explaining things to me, he simply ignored the two letters I wrote to him. It was at this stage that I wrote my fairly devastating sonnet and sent it to him. I think now, of course, that my sonnet was absurd, though, considered merely as poetry, it is one of the best I ever wrote. George's conduct to me was just typically English and nothing more. I believe that he honestly did not understand why I was making such a fuss. It appeared to him to be merely natural and inevitable that, if and when the moment came when it was convenient to drop his friend, he should do so. To me, as a Scotsman, and with my poetical temperament, his conduct appeared in the light of the blackest treachery. To him it was merely common sense and worldly policy. So, as I have said, he ended by thinking that he had been very badly treated, and went about saying so. Then I went to America, and just about that time George met Olive. Olive's interest in him began simply through his former friendship and association with me. She entertained his acquaintance because she liked to hear him talk about me and tell stories about me. George told her that I behaved very badly to him and showed her my letters. He got no sympathy from Olive, who, on the contrary, told him frankly that she considered that his conduct to me had been mean and unworthy. George took this to heart and entered into long explanations and excuses. He also, being a clever mimic, used to delight Olive by giving imitations of Bosey doing this, that, or the other. The result of all this was that they became very intimate. Olive made no secret of the fact that she adored me, but she agreed with what George said and constantly repeated to her, namely, that a marriage between us was not practicable, and that I did not want to marry her, and had never seriously thought of such a thing. Under these circumstances, when he told her he was in love with her, and repeatedly asked her to marry him, she ended by accepting him. Her mother, who was quite aware of her infatuation for me, did everything she could to encourage her with George. My wife admits that she did wrong to become engaged to George. When she accepted him, she fully meant to marry him, but, she says, quite rightly, that to have gone on with the marriage when she found out, as she did afterwards, that I really wanted to marry her, and in view of the fact that she loved me and did not love George, but only liked him very much, would not have been right to him or to me or to herself. I do not wish to say a word against George Montagu. He was at one time my friend, and, quite obviously, I was much fonder of him than he was of me, for I would not have dreamed of giving up his friendship to oblige my people or to conciliate my constituents. When he treated me as he did, I naturally felt bitter against him. When I returned from America and found that he was engaged to marry my girl, the blood of 100 Douglas ancestors surged up, and I said in my heart, "No, you don't." Leaving out the question of money, I knew that there was nothing against me as a husband for Olive which would not apply with at least equal force to him. George's treatment of me did not encourage me to think that his love for anyone would be likely to be of a lasting or irrevocable kind, and I determined to act swiftly and vigorously. I asked Olive to dine with me. She came, and when she told me, as she did, that she had agreed to marry George only because she thought that I did not want to marry her, and that I had irrevocably made up my mind to go in for the American heiress, I told her in reply that, of course, she must know that I adored her, that I had never cared two pins about any other girl, that I had given up all idea of the American heiress, and had come back to England simply because I could not live without her, and that I had always wanted to marry her, but had not thought it fair to ask her because I had no money at all, and would in future be almost entirely dependent on my mother. This interview took place in Kettner's restaurant. In the end, after much discussion, and in view of the fact that Olive did not for a moment deny that she cared more for my little finger than for George's body and soul put together, I asked her to run away with me. I told her that it was the only possible way we could be married, as, if her people got wind of it, such pressure would be brought to bear that we would inevitably be separated forever. Olive made an appointment to meet me a few days later. Curiously enough, we met on this momentous occasion, as we had done before, in the upper room of Robert Ross's little picture shop, Carfax, in Ryder Street, with his consent. Olive was then due to go down on the following day to spend the weekend at Hinchingbrook, Lord Sandwich's place in Huntingdonshire, to meet George's family. She told me that Mrs. Custance had, that morning, received a letter from the King congratulating her on her daughter's engagement to George. I told her that I would get a special license while she was away at Hinchingbrook, and that if she was game to do it, I would be awaiting her at St. George's, Hanover Square, at 9 o'clock on the following Tuesday morning, which was 4th of March, 1902. I did not see her again till the time specified. Up to the last, I did not feel perfectly certain that she would turn up. She was staying in Dover Street with her mother, and had to pack her things the night before, with the assistance of her maid, whom she took into her confidence. She told her mother that she was going to spend the day with her former governess, who lived somewhere in the suburbs, and she got out of the hotel without exciting any suspicion or comment, her maid going on to the station with the small portmanteau, which was all she could manage to smuggle out with her. I, in the meanwhile, arrived at the church 9 minutes before 9, accompanied by my sister, Lady Edith Fox Pitt, in her carriage and pair. I had persuaded her overnight to come with me to keep us in countenance. This she very kindly and loyally did, though, as was to be expected, she was blamed and abused for it afterwards. I had also told my mother at the last moment what I was going to do. My darling mother gave me £200, her fondest blessing, a diamond ring for Olive, and the promise of an allowance. My friend, Cecil Hayes, the well-known barrister, who was then private secretary to Lord Denbigh, and who afterwards appeared as my counsel at the ransom trial, and later when I was convicted and sent to prison for libelling Winston Churchill, came to the church to support me, and afterwards saw us off for Paris at Victoria Station. My darling little Olive arrived dead on time, and we were married. Before leaving Victoria, Olive sent a telegram to her mother informing her of what she had done, and giving our address in Paris. I subsequently discovered that Robert Ross, during the marriage ceremony, was in the church in the background. I had taken him into my confidence because, as I have already said, Olive and I used to meet occasionally at his little picture shop in Ryder Street. For some extraordinary reason, Ross always seemed to resent my marriage. All the same, I continued to be on good terms with him for several years after it took place, and he professed to be devoted to Olive, and made every effort to ingratiate himself with her. My wife, who sometimes has wonderful intuitions about people, never liked him or trusted him. Needless to say, our runaway marriage created a fearful rumpus. King Edward was, so I was told, very angry, though what on earth it had to do with him I have never been able to make out. The Montagues and the Yorks, with one accord, gave tongue, and worked themselves up into a fearful state of indignation and fury. This does not apply to poor George, who was merely sorrowful and dignified. Mrs. Custance was naturally in a great state of consternation, and Colonel Custance, who had only just returned from the South African War, where he had commanded the Norfolk Regiment, he was formerly in the Grenadier Guards, went through all the usual motions which are proper to the outraged father of an absconding daughter on such an occasion. I do not in the least blame him. Of course, it was a frightful blow to him that his elder daughter and heir, for his property was entailed on her, should have thrown aside a very eligible young man like George, heir to an earldom and about £30,000 a year, to run away with a penniless younger son who was, moreover, under a cloud, and who had been mixed up in the worst scandal that had occurred in London for about 100 years, If there is anything else that I have forgotten in this list of my ineligible qualities, the reader can please supply them ad lib. The first thing Colonel Custance did was, funnily enough, to rush round to Scotland Yard to make inquiries about me. He was no doubt disappointed to be told there that nothing whatever was known against me, and that, as far as their information went, I was a model of every virtue. Years afterwards, when he applied to the Chancery Court in an endeavour to take my only child away from me, the only charges that he could manage to rake up against me were that I was very bad-tempered, and that I attached far too much importance to religion. Within a few weeks of our marriage, however, he declared that he had forgiven us, and asked us to come down on a fortnight's visit to his house in Norfolk, Western Old Hall. Up to this point, I must say that he behaved exceedingly well, and the same applies to Mrs. Custance. Meanwhile, Olive and I were having the time of our lives in Paris at the Hotel Restat, now extinct. Out of the dust of the past, and surviving all the welter of the mud and stones that for more than 30 years have been thrown at me, and incidentally, though by no means always accidentally, hit my wife and made her life next door to impossible for her, our marriage still survives. Though we were subsequently separated 11 years later, and though almost superhuman, and I might add, entirely diabolical, efforts were made to smash up our marriage and force us into divorce or separation, we are still married and still love each other. It is the astonishing fact that certain persons, including one who has the best of all reasons to know the contrary, have tried to make out that our marriage was always a failure, and that after our brief honeymoon had been followed by the birth of our son, Raymond, it was one in name only. Nothing more fantastically or more grotesquely untrue could be devised by the brain of a lunatic. I am not concerned to produce proofs, though they exist in superabundance in the shape of letters exchanged between us, covering the whole period of our marriage, up to within a few months of our separation, and again with intervals of estrangement right up to the present day. Nor would one in the ordinary way think it necessary to say anything about what is, after all, a private affair between one's wife and oneself. But in view of posterity, which is as certain to be concerned in all this business as it is certain that there is a sun in the heavens, I put it here and now, and once for all on record, that the wicked efforts that were made to break up my marriage and to alienate my wife's affections never really succeeded. In the year 1907, I published in the Academy the series of sonnets which appear in my collected poems under the title To Olive. Those sonnets remain, and all the water in the sea will never wash them out. Here is one of them. To Olive. When we were pleasure's minions, you and I, when we mocked grief and held disaster cheap, and shepherded all joys like willing sheep who love their shepherd, when a passing sigh was all the cloud that flecked our summer sky, I floated on an unimagined deep. I loved you as a tired child loves sleep. I lived and loved and laughed, and knew not why. Now I have known the uttermost rose of love. The world is very strong, but love is stronger. I love you so, I have no time to hate even those wolves without. The great winds move all their dark batteries to our fragile gate. The years are very long, but love is longer. End of chapter 30.